All right. Hello again. This is our final session of the afternoon, and we're hoping you're enjoying the show, hoping you're taking advantage of everything. There's a lot to offer, even beyond the booths, just the G-Awards and things to do with the color presentation. So we hope you're checking all that out, maybe some ideas that'll come from that. Right now, we want to talk about an issue that is foremost in a lot of people's mind, which is supply chain. And no one has been untouched by this, either consumer or business. And we're really going to try to create an understanding, a little bit at least, of what the year ahead is going to be like and what it's going to be like for the home and houseware sector. We have Thomas Cook, who is Blue Tiger, I'm sorry, just space for a second, who is an expert on this, and hopefully will be able to give you insights that will allow you to approach the rest of this year with a little bit more knowledge and confidence. So,
great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Everybody can hear me fine, I hope. I'll get in the middle of you because some of you people are all the way back here. I have a PowerPoint presentation that I'm going to go through. I'm going to frame the issues on global supply chain. More importantly, as they get towards the middle to the end, I'm going to offer you recommendations and various concepts that my company has used to help companies in the last 30 years reduce their cost in their supply chain. And a lot of the practices and principles that we've used over the last 30 years are applicable in the last 2 years dealing with this COVID. My company, Blue Tiger International, goes back over 30 years. We help companies reduce risk and spend in their supply chain. That's what our focus is. We have a number of clients in your industry, and a number of them recommended that we come and talk about what we do and how we do it. A lot of people talk about, you hear the expression, well, he wrote the book on it, but I actually did. And I have a copy of it here, and I'd like to give it to one of you. But you got to earn it. So I ask a Trivial Pursuit question, you get it right, you get the book. So what city outside the United States receives more American visitors every year than any other city? What city outside the United States receives more American visitors every day than any other city? You can just guess.
Shenzhen,
no. London, no. Guangzhou, no. Bangkok, no.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong, no. You're not even in the right part of the world.
Tijuana.
There you go. Say it out loud.
Tijuana, really?
There you go.
Wow.
No way.
Good job.
Did you just guess that or did you know it?
I said.
Well, he should give you the book then.
He didn't win this. He won this.
If you've ever been there, the cars, the trucks, the people, the rail cars are all lined up, ready to go into Tijuana every day. They get about 25% more than the second most common area, which is actually Toronto, Canada. You don't get to European or Asian cities for a long way. You got other border crossings into Mexico and into Canada. So, one of the subjects that came up that they wanted me to talk about was sustainability. And at the end of the day, you can't have a sustainable supply chain if you don't control your risks and your costs. And in the last 2 years, that has been heightened so dramatically that it's almost impossible to control all your risks and your costs. And I'm going to focus on the concept that you can't reduce the problem or eliminate it, but you can mitigate it. Okay? And that's a key opportunity that we have in the supply chain. So what causes the issues that we're dealing with in the last 2 years? The first is the delay involved. Is anybody getting their freight on time here? Nobody is, okay? What normally would take a cycle of maybe 60, 90, 120 days to order something out of Asia and receive it, okay, is now extended as much as a year before we receive it, okay? And that situation is not getting better, it's getting worse. We may be getting used to it now, but the problem is getting worse every day. The costs. If I had a 40-foot container coming out of China, coming into the west coast of the United States in January of 2020, the average cost was about $2,500 for a 40-foot container. What do you think that container costs today? Well, $25,000, okay? The actual most we saw paid was $32,000, you know, what they call prime freight or premium freight, okay? Now, you just said that it's come back to $10,000. Actually, on December 7th, right, a date for a famous event in 1941, that was the turnaround for ocean freight coming out of Asia into the United States. That's where it peaked. And we now have seen now almost 12 weeks of the price either being stabilized or coming down. And one of the points I'm going to make to you in the summary, but I can say it now, is that for all of you, for planning purposes, okay, it's going to come down slowly, but it will never come down to where it was. Okay, at $2,500, the steamship lines couldn't make money. And I've been involved in the industry for 40 years, and they've never made money consistently. Okay, that magic number is going to be around $6,000 to $8,000 for a container. Okay, so for all of you, for budgeting and planning purposes, you want to think about that magic number for ocean freight. Air freight in January of 2020 was about $1.80 a kilo coming out of Asia into the USA. At the height, it was about $15. And it's still around $10 a kilo. The prices to and from Europe and Latin America are not quite as high as that, but much higher than they ever been previously. And again, the air freight pricings will never come down to where it was. Truck pricing. If I was to move a truck from California to New York, okay, in January of 2020, $1,700, $1,800, today as much as $5,000 or $6,000. Truck pricing is more likely to normalize and come down to where it was pre-COVID conditions. Just-in-time inventory management doesn't exist anymore. It was a big thing for the last 40 years in management of supply chains, in purchasing, inventory management, warehousing, distribution, but it doesn't exist anymore. And will it likely come back? We're looking at probably 2 or 3 years before the residual impact of the COVID problem will take hold. Maybe it will start to come back, but it will have different definitions on how it operates. That impacts purchasing, it impacts supply chain, and it impacts customer service and business development, meaning sales. The impact is in all modes of transportation, ocean freight, truck, air, and warehousing. Warehousing in the United States, traditionally, up to January of 2020, was at about a 72 to 73% capacity in the United States. Anybody want to take a guess what the capacity is today of warehousing in the United States? How much? 97. 97%. If somebody asked my company to help them get 50,000 square feet of warehousing space in the greater New York area or Los Angeles or Dallas or Chicago here, okay, you'd want to get 50,000 of contiguous space. That would be a pretty hard thing to do. Okay. That's because the inventory balances are just going through the roof. How many people here have more toilet paper in your home than you actually need? By a show of hands. Okay, you can raise it. Nothing, no consequence, right? Same thing with paper towels, canned goods, right? That's the problem, okay, which has caused the demand, okay, which has caused the potential incapacity. It's affected all countries around the world. In 40 years, we've seen freight disruptions and trade disruptions occur in all different parts of the world, but in little segments here and there. This is the first impact that has actually impacted the whole world. Most people who are old enough who experienced World War II would tell you that's the last time there was an impact in the supply chain that encompassed the entire globe. It impacts all business models, certainly this industry, which has a high degree of overseas manufacturing. if not of finished products, of components and raw materials. Okay, but every industry was impacted to some extent. And also every silo in every company, senior management. Normally in my business model, we deal with the vice president or director of supply chain, of purchasing, of foreign sales. That's the people, customer service that we deal with. But we've dealt with more CEOs in the last 2 years than we have in the last 40 years of our operation. Because supply chain costs and problems have escalated to such an extent, it's gone right up to the top of the C-suite. Okay? And they don't believe the people in their management teams when they say to them, it's going to take 7 months to get something over here. So they pick up the phone, they call us, and we reinforce that it is going to take 7 months, right? So it's a very interesting phenomenon. It impacts purchasing, sales, customer service, operations and manufacturing, and finance and legal have been impacted as well. It's definitely impacted demand planning. Anybody who has that position in a company today, that's a very difficult task to fulfill because you're trying to figure out when you need to buy something and how much you need to buy to fulfill that order when you have such uncertainty in the supply chain, not only from the manufacturing side, but in the transportation infrastructure of getting it from point A to point B. Procurement is impacted. The ability for a company to be resilient and create sustainability is impacted. Sales and business development. I've dealt with more irate salespeople who have orders but can't fulfill those orders or in customer service than we've ever had before. Margin, profitability, and growth has been impacted as well. And some companies have done reasonably well through the pandemic, but they could have done much better if they had product. And the whole subject of personnel working remotely is a very interesting phenomenon, which is now starting to change because COVID is starting to dissipate and companies are starting to bring people back and going into hybrid models. I do work for an organization in New York City called the American Management Association. The AMA did a survey in December of 3,500 senior executives in their clientele. And they did another survey at the same time to about 10,000 middle-level managers at the director level in companies. And at the director level, 50% in the survey answered the question that they'd like to be staying at home for their work. Said 50% said, we would like to continue to stay at home, and 50% said they can't wait to get back to the office. When senior management was asked the same question, what did they want to see? 95% they said they want to see everybody get back to the office as soon as they possibly can, which tells you that there's a concern about the effectiveness of managing people and their business model in a remote circumstance. So while a lot of companies are trying to figure ways to handle this, it will have an impact on all of us in just our general business responsibilities, but also have residual impact into how we manage our responsibilities in the supply chain. So the issue derives from demand and capacity. Think about how every company in the world operates, and your companies as well. How much do we manufacture? How many ships do I need to carry the cargoes from China to Los Angeles? How many trucks do I need to move freight from Dallas to Chicago? Every decision that has been made is based upon two factors. What's the historical data, and what's the preemptive data? What do they anticipate happening? But nobody anticipated when COVID hit that for February, March, April, and May, the world was going to stop, right? If you go back, it's only 2 years ago, we think about that time frame, right? We were all stuck in our homes. We didn't go to the businesses. We tried to make the best that we possibly can. Kids didn't go to school, and nobody went to work. The highways were empty, so forth. I traveled through the whole COVID theme because being in the supply chain, particularly with PPE, personal protection equipment, we were moving a lot of this stuff. So I was involved and traveled still around the world and through the country, and I could see, right, where everything kind of stopped. So when the world picked up again, starting at the end of April and May, everybody said, well, we don't have any inventory left. It's all gone. So there was this knee-jerk reaction to now never let that happen again and buy as much as we possibly could to bring freight and equipment and product into our warehouses and back into the supply chain. And that process that started in April, May of 2020 is now on steroids still. Here we are in March of 2022. So the transportation infrastructure has not been set up to handle this volume, period. There aren't enough ships, there aren't enough planes, there aren't enough trucks, there aren't enough chassis, there's not enough space in the pier. Washington, the president, and our Secretary of Transportation, they went to the Port of Los Angeles, and they came back saying, we got them to work 24/7, and we're going to relieve it. All they really did was, because there were 100 vessels anchored offshore that you could see, they had the Coast Guard move them 40 miles off, so you couldn't see them anymore. Okay? Now there's 125 of them there, and about 20 that are right just outside the harbor. The reality is that it was a rhetorical requirement because the longshoremen were working already 16 hours, the drivers were working 16 hours. All the capacity of chassis, trucks, and space on the pier was already consumed. There was no way it could go 24/7. And that same problem exists in New York and Savannah and Charleston and Houston and all these places. They have an infrastructure set up to handle a certain volume, and you can't say, I want to increase it just by increasing the number of hours. It's an impossibility. It's just rhetorical. So that demand, the capacity, also includes the process of getting the raw materials that make the components and the products that we use. So there's direct impact on manufacturers overseas as well as here in the United States. That impact on every transportation carrier, air, truck, rail, and vessel. The whole transportation infrastructure was stressed, and that stress is still there today, and it's still growing every day. Anybody who tells you that there's a diminishing amount of imports coming in is not paying attention to the data. Okay, the data tells us something different. It's growing by about 4 or 5% a month. And then we have the COVID politics and the reactions of our leaders, not only here in the United States, but around the world, which really has not been that sufficient for us in actually dealing with that problem. So the consequences is delays, cost increases, and we're all dealing with inflation when we go to the marketplace, and that's going to continue. And you can talk to a lot of different reasons why inflation is occurring, but a main reason inflation is occurring is because of the supply chain. So where is the resolution? It's not coming from Washington. You hear about them now investigating steamship lines, and they're going to go after some of the carriers and so forth. They don't have the teeth nor the bandwidth to be able to do this. The FMC is one of the smallest government agencies. It hasn't been funded with additional money. It's just been told to expand its powers. They're trying to change what's called the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. Okay, you're talking about a legislative process that's 2 years in the making. Okay, so there's no resolution that's going to come out of Washington. It's going to come out of the people in this room here and companies and the individuals who work for the companies navigating the challenges and finding solutions. Okay. In time, as demand diminishes, capacity increases, and the impact of COVID is stabilized, and we believe that we're at that point now where COVID has peaked and it's now on a diminishing trajectory. So the key is not to think that we can eliminate the problems, but we can mitigate the problems. And that's what I want to share with you now is some of the thoughts and things that we have found out. And at any point in time, if anybody has a comment or question, really just raise your hand or just speak out, okay? Make it more interactive. Resource development, coming to an event like this is important, but spending a lot of time with a lot of resources. We have about 25 resources that we use to help us make the decisions. There's a tremendous amount of data that's available in trade associations, trade groups, governments, and private data collection agencies that we use to help us with our decision making that we pass on to our clients. Maintaining a balanced approach to eliminate the knee-jerk reactions that typically occur. Getting creative is finding solutions. So I'll give you an example of a company that's similar to in your business vertical. But we have a company that has kitchen appliances that they buy under a private brand label, they come from about three different markets in Asia. But the highest concentration is in the Shanghai, China area. So they've been shipping for 25 years in cardboard boxes put into 40-foot containers being brought into various ports here in the United States. Well, you know, after 2 months delays and 3 months delays and 7 month delays and 9 month delays and prices going to $25,000 plus for a container, their margin was significantly impacted. As a matter of fact, they were taking a loss on most of their shipment activity. So they came to us and said, we got to find a better way. So what we ended up doing was we actually chartered a ship. Right? There are two basic types of ships out there. You have your container vessels, which is your most frequent availability, and you have break bulk vessels that don't take containers, but the holds open up and you load it up. And there are lots of those vessels in play. So we chartered a vessel which had the equivalent of 250 containers worth of freight. All we did was upgrade the packaging so that the load could take a little bit more of the dynamic pressures in transit, okay? And we moved 250 container loads in one shot, okay? And the supply chain executive we're working with now became a maritime executive because he was chartering a ship. He had to arrange longshoremen. He had to arrange trucks to pick up the goods at the pier and distribute them to wherever they were going to go. At the end of the day, while there was a lot more effort on the part of the supply chain department in this company, their pricing to get it to the United States and distribute it to their customers was 25% less than pre-COVID pricing. That was the cherry on the ice cream. Okay? And that was done in September of 2020. We've now done four of those vessels, movements. And that's taken a more creative approach on what things that are available. The last one we did, we had to use a bigger vessel, so we ended up reaching out to a number of companies who all said we would love to jump onto that ship. So we ended up filling the ship with other clients and other customers. Patience and planning. We'll share with some of those things in a moment that you could do. So we get in tremendous amount of historical data, and I have four data analysts working on my staff. We look at future demand. Public companies have to put this out there. The Department of Commerce and the Census Bureau and a number of trade organizations, one being the Institute of Supply Chain Managers, as being one of the leaders in this, they calculate this data and put it out every month in a public venue. Through quantitative analysis using analytics, tied into qualitative analysis using our experience and our sensibilities, okay, and then taking information about the COVID and trying to decide from the information we've got, projecting that out of what was going to happen. The example of the last variant that hit us, okay, we projected that back in the summer, that come the fall and towards December, there was going to be a disaster, so we slowed everything down because of that, and that actually happened. But now the data is showing us what we believe is that we've reached the peak and we're on the downside of it now. So we come up to some conclusions, which is that we don't believe that the delay will end until the end of 2022 and into the first quarter of 2023. How do we know that? Is because even if the demand stopped today, there's still a 7 to 8 month residual backup in the supply chain, meaning ocean carriers, air carriers, trucking, warehousing to get their freight where it needs to be. Okay? But the demand isn't going to stop. It's still going up by 4 to 6% a month. The expectation from the Department of Commerce is that here in the United States, and likely the world will follow, that demand will start to drop off sometime around July or August. So if you add in that 7 or 8 month delay and residual impact, you're looking at probably the first quarter of 2023 before we're going to see real relief. But remember what I said about the pricing, though. The ocean freight pricing, we think, has already peaked and is now starting to come down every day. So ocean freight, January 2020, $2,500, China to the United States. November 2021, $12,000. February 2022. Now it's back down to that $15,000, $16,000 level, and some of the bigger companies are getting it at around $10,000. And as I said before, we don't think it's going to go down to where it was. When everything gets better, it's going to level out at around $6,000 or $8,000. So some of the things that we need to think about doing as steps is we need to manage our suppliers more vigorously. And if we have suppliers that depend upon other suppliers for raw materials or components to help you create a finished product, then sometimes you have to manage down to their suppliers and have to get involved. Increase safety stock levels. Generally, we use a rule of thumb that a company tries to have around 20% of safety stock. Okay? We're now moving that up to around 35-40% at this point. Order 4 to 6 months in advance. If we typically order 2 months out or 3 months out, add 4 to 6 months to that time frame. Increase the number of suppliers. Loyalty to suppliers is a great thing. It's important. But at the same time, you need to investigate other options. I'm going to talk about China in a moment as a significant source of supply into the United States, but really I'm going to look at it from a very cautionary standpoint. We've spent more time in the last 2 years in moving companies out of China, finding alternative countries around the world that can provide the product at a similar acquisition price, but at a much lower landed cost. I'll talk about that in a moment. And potentially ship direct to customer. When I was walking from the hotel over here, I was walking with one of your company executives, and she was talking about the fact that she's having a lot of problems in her supply chain shipping to one of the largest retailers in the United States. And that retailer has a consolidation facility in China. And we've taken about a dozen companies that normally ship to the United States and then ships to that company's distribution center. We had them drop ship to that retailer's consolidation facility. They actually had three of them, Shenzhen, Ningbo, and Shanghai. So they take out the ocean freight component and they deliver it to them and let them handle the inbound ocean freight. I'm very willing to do that, obviously, for a cost consideration. Lowering the landed cost. You need to have a landed cost model in your supply chain, meaning you need to know what the cost is, not only to acquire the merchandise, but to bring it to point of value to you. Okay? So we have the acquisition cost, we have freight, which we all know is out of control. We have the customs clearance process, we have duties and taxes, we have inland freight, warehousing, and distribution, and looking at it in a very simple model. What we try to do is pick apart all those areas to see which ones we can impact. Freight right now, unless we can charter a ship, is very difficult to impact that. So we focus on these other areas. Acquisition cost. Acquisition cost meaning maybe we should look at an alternative supplier somewhere else. Duties and taxes is a big area. I'm going to share with you about 7 examples of how we can impact duties and taxes on the goods that are coming in. And if you're buying things from China and you're paying the 301 duties or the 232 duties where you're paying a 25% surcharge, that can be eliminated. So, alternative sourcing, controlling the freight purchase, the Incoterm, freight consolidation, robust supply chain assessments, demand planning process. Mexico Maquiladora. In the Clinton administration, he created a program to help stem the flow of immigrants coming in from Mexico into the United States. The thought process was if we could create jobs for them in Mexico, they wouldn't want to come into the United States. So they created a program where if a U.S. company or a foreign company wanted to build a plant for manufacturing or assembly in Mexico, where the goods would eventually end up in the United States, that the government would put together a tax benefit program for that company in Mexico, and any components or raw materials coming into that plant would come in duty-free, and when the finished product came out, it would now come into the United States duty-free. And it's called the Maquiladora program. In the United States, of the Fortune 1000 companies, 62-63% have a direct or an indirect interest in the maquiladora program. It's a swath of land that's about 50 miles wide from our border points going from California all the way to Texas. So in your business, one of your companies in your business came to us, and they had a division that was buying furniture from China. For those of us that travel a lot, we stay in hotels. When you stay in a hotel today, next to your bed, your night table has connectivity. You can plug your phone in, you can plug devices in. When you go to the bathroom, there's connectivity. There's a desk that has connectivity, all that. So this company created furniture where they had this connectivity. So this company would build the furniture in China, and they had a deal with an electronics company in China who would move to them all the electronic components. They'd put it together and ship in this finished product, subject to the 301 tariffs, so there was a 25% surcharge. But the demand for that was pretty significant all through the Trump administration and even to this date. So being creative and looking at the options, as we turned around and said to that supply chain operation, is why don't we just get the wood knocked down from that Chinese supplier? Let's get the electronics in boxes coming into Mexico, okay? And we found a contract manufacturer, okay? So when those goods go from China to Mexico and they pass through the border, there's no duty or taxes because it's going into the maquiladora program. Now Mexican labor comes in, assembles the product, brings the wood together, electronics together. Where did it become a desk with connectivity is Mexico. So the country of origin is Mexico. It's not China, and it comes in duty free. And we've just eliminated the duty and tax that was previously added. Yeah, there's a little bit of additional cost relative to that extra shipping charge, but it was negligible relative to the savings that was involved with this account, okay? So the Mexican Maquiladora program is an excellent option for alternative sourcing. And as I said before, the larger companies in America, the Fortune 1000, about 62-63%, are already taking the benefit of that program. And also a lot of foreign manufacturers. Samsung has one of the largest assembly facilities for their TV sets in Tijuana. The demand planning process. One of the things that we look at in the demand planning process is we sit back and say, how much of a company's spend is on expedited or air freight services as compared to ocean freight? And if it's more than 5%, that's a red flag to us. Why is a company using expedited services or air freight to move something? And generally, when we pick it apart, it's because something failed in their demand planning process. And now they had to hurry things from a supplier to their distribution facility. So we look at the demand planning process to see what steps could be taken to improve that, to make it work better, and try to get that expedited spend from, you know, millions of dollars to hundreds of thousands of dollars. We know it has to happen in some cases, but it shouldn't happen as often as it does. Other solutions, foreign trade zones. Foreign trade zones is an economic area located in the United States. It could be the back of your warehouse. It could be a small part of your warehouse. It could be part of your freight forwarder's warehouse. It could be if you're using a 3PL for warehousing distribution, it could be at their facility. The goods come into the foreign trade zone. When they cross through the border, there is no responsibility to pay duties or taxes. It's not entering the U.S. economy. It's only coming into the United States physically, but not economically, so no duties or taxes get paid. So the first advantage of a foreign trade zone is that you defer the duty and tax obligation. Depending upon your turn, that could be a huge advantage. The second is that your customs clearances and your merchandise processing fees, which are paid to customs, come down dramatically because you don't have transactional clearances anymore. Once a week, when the goods come out of the facility, okay, that's the only time it's declared to U.S. Customs. If the goods get exported, let's say they go to Mexico or they go to Canada or to the Caribbean or to Latin America, where you're doing distribution, you'll never have to pay duties or taxes because the goods would never have entered the United States. If you bring it into the foreign trade zone and you do manufacturing, assembly work on that stuff that comes in, okay, then there's what's called a tariff shift from the raw material or component to a finished product, and you end up paying the lower of the duty rates on the component or the finished product. And generally, finished products have lower duty rates than components and raw materials. Every foreign car manufacturer now assembles their cars and manufactures here in the United States. Toyota, Honda, BMW, Ford, all of them operate in foreign trade zones because of the advantage that they get. You bring in a tire or an engine, the duty rate is 7, 8%. You bring in a finished car, it's only 2%. Cars manufactured here in the United States, not overseas anymore, in our foreign trade zone. So it has great benefit. Bonded warehousing works like a foreign trade zone. It just, you're not allowed to materially change the product in a bonded facility. Tariff engineering is legitimately making some changes to the product that allows it to come in at a lower duty rate. An example is, if we put Gore-Tex on a fabric and we make it waterproof, we eliminate the duty. Okay, and some companies may not need that, but the process of putting some, you know, ability to handle the product like Gore-Tex can might be less expensive than the duty rate. Okay, so that's an example of tariff engineering. Drawback. If we import something that gets exported, we go back to customs and we can reclaim the duties and taxes that were originally paid. 99% of them come back to us in a program called Drawback. Domestic distribution. Another company in your business does pots and pans. They've been in that business for over 50 years. They're based in Nashville, Tennessee. They've been bringing everything from overseas now into a distribution facility in Nashville, Tennessee, and they distribute to all their customers all over the United States. When we looked at the demographics of where their customers were, they had as many clients west of the Mississippi as they had east of the Mississippi. The cost of shipping from Nashville to west of the Mississippi was pretty significantly more than it was east of the Mississippi. So we looked at and eventually moved them into a secondary warehouse in Reno, Nevada, where the cost of the warehouse, the cost of the insurance, the leasing costs, personnel costs, all were about 20% lower, okay? And they were able to reduce their domestic transportation costs by as much as 25% by putting themselves in a much better domestic distribution facility for half their business. Robust and aggressive export sales. It doesn't have to be necessarily made here. There are a lot of companies, particularly in your business vertical, that export products that you've imported because a lot of places around the world much prefer doing business with the United States as a supplier and as a distributor. You can give better credit terms. You're more responsible in handling your supply chain responsibilities. We have a very good, solid infrastructure for transportation and distribution. Okay? And eliminate a lot of the headaches in dealing with a lot of places. And appreciate that a lot of companies now, also around the world, are suffering as a result of COVID, and a lot of them have had disruptive in their supply chains from various places. So if the U.S. can fulfill that order now, it's really created robust. We look at the statistics, exports have now grown through COVID from the United States in about 9 different verticals, and one of them is yours. So we created a process. It's 4 steps, something to think about. The first is an assessment process. You want to dissect your supply chain. You want to take your landed costs, break it out in those 6 categories, and then see where there's the opportunity that could potentially provide some benefit. Once you choose some of the options, you want to create a financial model to make sure that anything that you're going to do is going to have a return on the investment. Next is the operational model. What do you have to do to make something happen? So I mentioned the foreign trade zone as an example, or the use of a maquiladora. Well, you have operational concerns that you have to deal with because you're moving freight differently and you're positioning goods differently. So you have to think about, what do I have to do differently to make that happen? So you need to look at your operational capabilities and what changes you have to make to make those things work. And then implementation is just making it happen. And I have 0 to 90 days. The average time from analysis to seeing benefit for us is around 90 days, which is really pretty quick in this time because it's a snap of the finger at the end of the day. So the mitigation process works for imports, exports, domestic business, freight, warehousing, distribution, duties and tariffs, purchasing, sourcing, vendors, suppliers, the buildup of your sales, and particularly in the area of export business development. Some additional thoughts is you really need to think of your future as it relates to China, both as a source, as a supplier, and also as potentially a buyer. We have significant issues which are actually being personified now, trade compliance, forced labor issues. I've had 5 clients in the last 60 days have their freight seized at U.S. Customs, not because they came from a supplier that had forced labor. They came from a geographic area in China that is now being identified as having forced labor. So they paid for the goods, paid for the shipping, the goods are here and they're seized. So they lose all that money and access to the merchandise. It's a huge loss, becoming a much more important issue. If you just go to Customs website, it'll identify the companies overseas in China you can't buy from and the areas that cause concern. Freight disruption, as I said, till the first quarter of 2023, cost delays, the demand planning process is the thing that's critical. Technology will play a greater role in global supply chain. Technology allows the operational side of all the recommendations that we mentioned occur. And remember that it's generally not one solution that's offered. It's generally multiple steps that have to be taken to mitigate the problems. In technology specifically, particularly for you who might be importing, PO management systems really help you get a hold of the relationship with your vendor and all the documentation and all the data that's required to move your goods inbound into the United States. You have to be concerned with export controls of who we sell to and where we sell around the world. The technology creates tremendous amount of efficiencies. It's also a resource for data and also allows for the government interface. Here in the United States, almost all imports and exports are done electronically. There's no more moving documentation to the government manually. And most of the Western world has already adopted that, and now the dominant players in the Asian world, such as Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, and China, are also following that suit as well, eliminating paper and moving to technology. So with that, you're all welcome to reach in and answer any questions, whether you have them now or whether you have them afterwards. So I appreciate all your kind attention, and we'll take any questions that you might have. Yes. So not sure if you heard that question, but the question is what impact shipping costs will be have as a result of the Ukraine and Russia conflict that we're dealing with now. If you're just moving containerized goods to and from Europe, to and from Asia, to and from Latin America, there's going to be very little impact on cost or time. If you're moving anything into the Ukraine or Russia or in and out into that area, Crimea, right? You're going to see significant delays. Russia has already closed down the port structure in that part of the world now. And as everybody knows, the whole world has kind of turned pretty ugly for Russia. So a lot of transactions have pretty much stopped, okay, and there's hardly any activity. So if Russia is part of your supply chain, that's going to be pretty disrupted. And same, obviously, with Ukraine. And Belarus seems to be aligning itself, even though it's a NATO country, with Russia. So those three places would be a problem. But the rest of the world will continue to move pretty well. I think where it will happen is if the U.S. cuts off Russian energy, right, which is being considered, because that would really hurt them more than the other sanctions that they put forth, you'll see pricing in gasoline go up in consumers to over $6, and you'll see the price for jet fuel and for bunker fuel, which is what goes into the ships, all escalate as well. And what you'll see is surcharges that everybody's going to charge you. Trucking companies, the steamship lines, airlines will have surcharges relative to fuel.
Yeah, because that's what I was seeing in the news until this morning. That
right.
That's a possibility.
Right. Which, just politically, everybody understands is people say, well, why isn't the government just shutting Russia down? It's because the impact will be that we'll all be paying $6 a gallon when that happens. And politically, they don't want to see that happen right now. That's the reason that they haven't cut that off yet. But they're getting to the point because the problem is so great now in Ukraine and the civilian casualties are getting so high that it's likely that's probably going to happen. Right. And I appreciate the fact that the U.S. also will have to take a position in its own energy production because we have the capability if they open it up.
Okay.
Right? So.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any more questions?
Any other questions?
Okay.
Up here we go.
So this is more about the maquiladora process. So is that a process that we could take advantage of for like final assembly of kitting?
Yes.
Really?
Yep.
So if we bring in all the components for a kit, bring it in through the maquiladora process, final kitting and boxing is done in Mexico, that would alleviate a lot of the duties.
For one of the larger cosmetic companies in the United States last year, they were bringing various cosmetics, the kind of thing where if a woman goes to Macy's and spends $50, she gets a whole kit of all this gift stuff, right? So that's, they have to put like 10 items together. So they were doing that in the U.S. So we moved them to Mexico, to Matamoros, and that's where that's being done now. So the goods come from various places around the world into Mexico, duty-free, and Mexican labor brings it together, and then they move it up by truck to two distribution centers, one on the West Coast and one on the East Coast, and then it goes all out. Perfect fit for it.
Okay, and then the opposite side of that is, let's say we bring a ton of components in, let's say 70% of the inventory gets kitted, the other 30% is sold as individual SKUs. Do we pay duties on the remainder of those 30% SKUs?
No. If nothing happens to that, if there's no physical change, the answer would be yes.
Got
you'd
it.
Pay the duty rate between whatever the country of origin was and in the relationship to the United States. But if it became part of the transaction, but nothing happened to it, then that would be, no duty would apply. For example, if you bought a cell phone and the case was included with the sale, right?
Mm.
So now it would become, you're not doing anything to that case, but it now becomes part of the sale.
Interesting. So, okay, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you. Another question.
Thank you. And I want to piggyback off of the maquiladora program question. So if you were a retailer and you were consolidating out of China, could you now consolidate out of Mexico?
The initial answer would be yes, but you have to look at the details of what the products are, what you're actually going to do.
For example, you brought up furniture, home textiles, electronics, it sounds like.
All perfect examples.
Appliances as well?
Yes, appliances as well. All your major Korean manufacturers now do that work, where they bring the parts in from South Korea and China into Mexico, and they build the refrigerator and the stove and the microwave and the 50-inch TV and everything using Mexican labor for that purpose.
Because I'm based in the Virgin Islands.
Okay.
And I bring in stuff from all over the place. But to your point, what you've made is that it's getting harder.
Correct.
With the tariffs and different things like that.
Right. A lot of companies that work in the Caribbean or operate in the Caribbean will use Miami as the foreign trade zone and the hub to distribute to them.
Yes.
Okay, so that could potentially, you don't necessarily have to have it where you are. You could have it at a closest point of use. And Houston as well is also a place that it gets done as well. And other places, but Miami probably has the most robust capability right now.
Where I can bring something in, but don't necessarily have to pay duty on it.
You got it.
And it goes straight to, okay.
Right.
All right, thank you. Anyone?
Great, okay.
I think that's our time.
Okay.
Tom, thank you very much.
Welcome.
And thank everybody for their attention. Again, there'll be summaries and there will be a recording of the whole session online on the IHA site. So if you want to go back and refer to that, please do. It should be up fairly shortly. And otherwise, thank you and enjoy the rest of the show.